You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore, on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM. Today, I'd like to introduce and welcome John Gorski of Seattle for our program. He's going to regale us with many, many poems of Americana, much music, allusions to poets famous and some not so famous, some obscure that he might explain. But John was born in Missouri, lived throughout his childhood and adolescence in Maryland and Ohio, which are brought up as part of his career in poems that we'll hear. So he's had a rich life in poetry since he came to Seattle in the mid-70s after he got an English degree at University of Cincinnati. And so here in the gray city where he seeks perhaps to clear himself of a very loud anonymity, we hope that we can help you boost your fame in poetry. So let's welcome John Gorski. Glad you're here, John.
Thank you very much, David. The first poem is Ancestral Reverb, and it is about my maternal grandfather who lived in Tennessee. The rivers of Middle Tennessee have devious currents that can drag a body to rest. So he never wanted his 8 children to learn how to swim. Wood does not cost nothing, he exclaimed to the sawdust circus of his sons running around his shop, knocking over a cane-backed chair he was working on. In the Great Depression, he was trying to feed his family on a cabinet maker's wages. He loved the stained glass sun streaming on Sunday mornings, but not the starched white certainties of his mother's church that counted only sinners outside its sect. He read Poe stories and painted as a young man until one day he took a razor to his canvases. It was the night river thoughts drowning him, the 2 a.m. freight train out of Nashville with its unbearable blaring horn that came with his heritage. He knew about the translucent hill people miles to the east who plucked out Barbara Allen on banjo and guitar in the pitch black hours in the same way it had been brought over from Scotland centuries before. A music that sounded in his insomnia. Decades later, when his eldest daughter witnessed the dawn horizon as a seam of coal, she heard his voice telling her to look west. The next one is about my paternal grandparents who were from New York City. My grandparents relived the last century. I've driven one wheel of my subcompact over the curb, trying to park in the overcrowded, caffeinated bohemia of 21st century Capitol Hill. "Ach, ach, use your head," my German grandfather exclaims through the reverb of my neural circuits. "But don't be stupid and park too far away from the curb, or your midget car will get sideswiped by one of those armored personnel carriers, also known as all-wheel drive sports utility vehicles that take up half a street." By an open second-story window, my grandmother sits in her easy chair, her face half in shadow. Below, engines rev as the traffic threads by buildings, sepia in the Queen's twilight. She listens to the dark, ringing with the voices of her teenage sons getting off the Fresh Pond Road L station in 1935. But it is 40 years later, and they live in Delaware and Ohio. Her husband is many years dead. Her gin-running playing lady friends have retired to Florida. She hears their laughter in the breeze from Sheepshead Bay. a pale green plastic duck that one of the neighbor children left there this morning glows in the corner of the living room. She had somehow passed it by when her vacuum cleaner harmonized this morning's Lutheran hymns in German. I hear her over the years muttering, "Ach, ach," as she puts it on the coffee table, so as not to spoil her hausfrau ideal of uncluttered living space. Its luminous color reminds her of April and the linden trees of her New Jersey girlhood. And this next one is about growing up in Maryland and in the Baltimore Annapolis area. This is Daydream and Shadow. After the Pledge of Allegiance, the class sang, "Oh Maryland, my Maryland," our state anthem of hackneyed praise set to the tune of "O Tannenbaum." And then we sat down to arithmetic, but I thought of peanut butter cookies waiting in the cafeteria, and my mind flew off with the balmy September sky pouring through the windows with a sunlit haze of attention deficit disorder that scrambled the numbers of the lesson. But my slightly taller shadow whispered incognito, "Follow the instructions and finish. That's how you get along." Sometimes a cold wind blew down the coast from Sheepshead Bay to the Chesapeake with rainy syllables hectoring on Saturday mornings when my father checked my math assignment like an East Prussian pedagogue in General Electric light. Then I wanted to bolt to the fair weather recess fields of Glendale Elementary, where I could play baseball with my friends or go farther to a silent, vacant place under the halcyon vault that was the absence of my parents and sang in an epiphany of notes. But then my shadow self arose like voices from open windows in 1,000 Brooklyn apartment buildings that chorused, "Your parents are looking for you." On a street corner, a payphone rang. I picked it up and heard, "This is your father. Your mother and I have been worried sick about you."
So you're not afraid of having important coincidences appear in your homes. Not too many would lift up a phone and find that it was for them. But you knew that it was going to be your parents?
My parents were strong influence, of course, like anyone's parents. But, my dad was from New York City, and he was Germanic, you know, although it's a Polish name. He was actually, me and my sister, who's interested in a family background, figured out he was a Germanized Pole. His father was. His mother was from Alsace-Lorraine, which he was a quarter French and three quarters German, but very heavily Germanic on my father's side. And then my mother's side is like to more artistic people, as opposed to my father, who's very orderly and mathematical. So two yes. Different sides there. Your childhood forms you, they used to say in the 50s or 60s, your basic personality is formed by the time you're 5 years old. So adolescence and going to college didn't influence me too. But
the East Prussian element of your father, did he come from Europe, or was it his parents?
No, it was actually his grandparents on both sides came over around in the 1870s and 1880s. And they both wound up first around the New York area. And although my father's paternal grandfather wound up in Ohio for a while too, and actually wound up in Cincinnati, went to college at Denison University.
You certainly move around and get a feeling of how your life's career was. Well, you're on the move quite a lot in your poems. Go so vignette.
And again, this is mostly set in Maryland, with the last vignette being set in Cincinnati. Tree stump with tonsorial ambitions. My dad hated the Elvis and Little Richard 45s I played in my room. So sometimes I escaped to a nearby playing field, edged by the traffic squawk of Ritchie Highway, to daydream of rhythm and blues stardom. I used to notice a beheaded tree there with new branches growing from its stump in a ragged green array that reminded me of my pompadour fails when I attempted to comb my dry hair in the style of my swivel-hipped Memphis idol. The new overlord, behind the mulberry bush on the east side of her house where I stood one day during a game of hide and seek, I saw a black sunflower in my mother's garden. It shaded the roses and would grow in my brain in these years to come, casting night upon the buttercups running wild. Merry-go-round. Under a wan Baltimore sky at the end of summer, a merry-go-round spun in Carlin's amusement park. Among the standard ponies with painted wooden eyes was a group of three donkeys with long ears and single-minded stares that fixated upon the onlookers. Their leering orbs withered any hope that I might entertain a free will and seem to know the dark story of my future. And this one is set in a neighborhood in Cincinnati, image in a College Hill shop window. In the storefront glass, I saw two Bavarian descended high school boys reflected behind me. Their incisive chuckles turned the azure day acerbic as the afternoon revolved in my head with street phrases becoming taunts. And this next one is about my older sister. And again, it's mostly set in Maryland. The eldest daughter. In the living room, a glass-faced courier and Ives hung, picturing a dark mare galloping north over flat tidewater land. Empty saddled, it raced toward Baltimore with the mystery of its rider's demise. An oversized easy chair took up a corner. The three children loved to jump onto its great upholstered body when their parents were away. One night it was vacant under a large bright lamp which shone like that month's harvest moon. In another room, the first child was putting coins into Henny Penny, her ceramic bank poured from the mold of a matronly chicken. Teddy Bricks, the second child's ursine toy, raised his steel bones on the bed after doing his daily regimen of mechanical somersaults. A small gray plastic house lay on a window ledge there. One door opened on a kindly old woman brushing away leaves from the steps. The other door brought a witch to sweep the skies into an Atlantic storm, raising roofs and waterspouts up and down the eastern seaboard. Later as a teen, the eldest daughter was popular and made good grades, though she drew fashion models in her notebooks during class. She went swimming and boating with her friends on the Magathie. She played badminton in the backyard with her brother in the humid mosquito air of summer and listened to Joan Baez records in her room. Then she went off to college in Pennsylvania, but wrote home every couple of weeks. That year, a student from her old school fell off the pier and drowned in the Severn. In the summer, the family moved to Ohio. She had met a boy at college and they were engaged. One night, the next autumn, the moon appeared with blood staining his face. The following week, a hospital back east called with news of a highway wreck and the eldest daughter. Afterwards, oldest brother would only see her in the half light of thought, this girl with no future writing dreams in her diary.
You had foreshadowed.
Yes, I had.
The death there with the drowning of another person. How you animated that poem with the animals of childhood and also animated the figures in the child's plastic house. And that's very, very nicely done to create the normalcy of life, you know, that a child would have. A miniature epic with a very, very sad, perhaps tragic ending.
It was, yeah, very bad. She was only 19 when that happened. So.
Oh, dear.
Okay, now this one is about how I moved with my family to Cincinnati, Ohio in the mid-60s. This is Charmed Estuary. Through my 20s, the Chesapeake would reach out its tidewater arms in the waking dark before day. The sunlight upon it infused with the memory of my sister's blonde hair. Almost 17, I entered a city of hills bordered by the serpent coil of the Ohio River. With my family, I rode through the sallow-faced Bavarian streets, past the weathered brick of Catholic churches, spiring the lucite gray of overcast Midwestern skies. One summer, a few years later, I found myself in Mount Airy Forest, wrapped in a murky charcoal night. A hound was tracking me with hallucinogen breath, strobe eyes, and the snarl of 1,000 out-of-tune violins. I waited until his howl stopped ringing in my bloodstream and finally came fractured to a white pastel sun, filling an upstairs room in my parents' house. I could never return to the laughter under the green oaks along the shores of that gull-voiced estuary after my sister left us.
This is the first one, I think, in my reading of your poems where you do begin to get darker, perhaps somewhat nightmarish, in the aftermath of your sister's death. It strikes another chord, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And the whole thing is about the 60s. We moved there in 64. And then, you know, like you were alive then. The 60s just got really wild, you know. And then that line about the snarl of 1,000 out-of-tune violins, that it was about a bad LSD experience to have.
You know?
So you can sort of see that there. And so the hound. And that was a poem that I wrote for the Dante class. And I've seen a picture of illustrated Dante's Inferno, and there's a dog following him. So that's where I got from that. You know, the hallucinogen breath and all that just conjures up the 60s. And it was a traumatic decade for me and just for a lot of people that age. So I mixed it in with my sister's death, which was a few years earlier than that, you know, but. Well, Cincinnati was named after Cincinnatus, who was a Roman general.
Tell us about the House of the Rising Sun modus, how you have used House of the Rising Sun here.
I was trying to learn how to play guitar in my late teens, and I failed pretty badly because I have very, very little musical talent, but I tried anyway. And I learned how to play that song, but it took like 3 nights of 2 hours a night. And I was playing the melody of it too, but it was just... And that was just my late teens, and I dropped out of college, second year of college. I was having a lot of problems, so I kind of mixed that in. But you would find out in the poem I tell you about it, but it was just kind of discouraging not to be able to play guitar. And I had friends that were good musicians, but I'd never been able to do it. So I always gravitated towards the lyrics, you know, in songs. And around that time, of course, it was like the Dylan and Paul Simon and the Beatles, a little later Leonard Cohen. And, you know, so I could get that part and then I had some ability there, but, you know, I pretty much tone deaf really. But I am attracted to songs with meaningful lyrics. And this is written in couplets. For hours, he picked the blues melody the animals had on the top 40. Plain in the summer's conflagration, he stumbled upon Nerval's black sun. Trying to learn guitar in Tennessee, he found an untuned cacophony. Teenage angst was the diagnosis that the doctors pronounced in Memphis. He left school and went back to Ohio, where new doctors added to his bio. There he lost a month to electroshock and woke up to children chanting up the block. He slept late into the humid mornings at his parents' house, immune to scorning. He gorged on daytime TV, groggy with Thorazine police sanity. His mind's cinema was in black and white, the projection machine shone a gray light. One day the doctor stopped his medicine and a rainbow crossed his vision again. He sold his six string for $20 and lost his bipolar Delta holler. He was back, but still felt a little strange there at home, home on the autism range.
Very good. Very good. The rainbow image there brightens it up wonderfully well.
I was put on some antipsychotics and the world is kind of gray and monochromatic, you know, when you're on that sort of medication. You know, literally it doesn't look gray, but it feels gray.
So now we move on to still another time, but we're in the Northwest here.
That's right. This is like the first year or two I lived in the Northwest. It's about a girlfriend I had then. And this is called The Green Chair and the Miller High Life Glass. I hope no one kamikaze strafes your apartment. It's so dreary, my girlfriend groused. She had wanted to go to Vito's for dinner, but we were both on SSI and mendicants of the food stamp culture in 1977 when I first lived in Seattle. So I was wary of expense. Later, we headed into the March wind on Madison Street toward downtown and the ragged yellow banner of Birchfield twilight blowing above Elliott Bay. The photo on your Metro Pass makes you look like you just got off the swing shift at a concentration camp, she remarked, as we waited at 2nd and Union for our bus to Tukwila. Perusing that picture years later, I would say it made my unshaven face, gaunt and elegant, appear like an apprentice to an anorexic werewolf. Back in my kitchen, I reached for the Miller High Life glass, but fumbled it and watched the vessel from Woolworth shatter at my feet. Then I went into the main room and listened to the portable GE radio while reclining in the green upholstered chair I had bought the August before. A few weeks earlier, my girlfriend nodded off on her anti-seizure medicine and burned a hole in the armrest with her cigarette. The soft rock station was playing Barry Manilow's Trying to Get the Feeling Again, soothing me with his plaintive flute intro I'd heard on airplane headphones when I flew out here. After my girlfriend and I broke up, we swept aside the shards of our downbeat time together by telephone. Other friends from the day treatment program we were both in would visit then, and we'd talk about Pink Floyd and Sid Barrett's Paranoia. Sometimes when I hear the Manilow song unexpectedly, I see hers and other faces I knew when I first roamed these cloudy streets above the 47th parallel.
So that does depict a rather dreary life that you were trying to pull yourself together in. It just wasn't easy for you in those days. It definitely is a difficult city when you're struggling.
Oh, yeah. And you saw a lot of people like that. And anyway, I met my girlfriend. I was at an outpatient program for people with mental and emotional problems. So, aside from that, I guess I didn't break out. There's a lot of beauty. There's so much beauty in Seattle. Where I came from in Cincinnati, it was just cloudier here, but it was cooler here. And just, you know, all the evergreen trees and the mountains and stuff. You don't have that back in the Midwest where I came from. So I appreciate that. I don't know if that came through, but that line about the sunset, like a banner of Birchfield twilight. He was a painter from Ohio. I looked at a lot of his paintings. So it just reminded me of one of his paintings. So That's why I inserted that.
When you bring in art, do you often incorporate some of the imagery and color from that art? Later on with Van Gogh, it's more explicit. I did sense exploiting once in a while pictorial art here.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I make a lot of painterly references, you know.
And musical art, too, not just
pictorial. Definitely that, too. But the visual is always easier because I had some artistic talent on my mother's side. So I mentioned that with my grandfather, I think. That's where it all came from. My aunt had 2 degrees in art, and she got to a point where she was selling paintings in her 50s and 60s and have given exhibits, you know, but it didn't really happen to her early 50s. But there's definitely a lot of that on my mother's side. My mother painted too, but she didn't go to art school. She went to library school, and you know, she liked to read a lot. So,
well, we have a Dura ceiling.
First part of this is set in the Baltimore Annapolis area, and the second part is set in Seattle in the late 70s. Was it a party? No one was waving to us from those Miller Time lit windows as a school friend and I drunkenly stared from balmy October shadows that evening in 1962. His older sister and pals there rocked to the Beach Boys with midshipmen from the Naval Academy and Madras attired teens whose eyes flashed superiority. I was 5'6", standing straight up in my penny loafers, so they bore me aloft on a whim, out to the front yard while my brain swam. That was the night I met my double, the socially ill-fitting Vern, in that wasp abode in Pines and the Severn. Was it a party or a prank excuse? So Dave asked me over to his unit in Holly Park early one night in 1979. And like any monotone lark, I accepted the invitation. It was a dead midwinter evening closed by a gray Albrecht Dürer ceiling that had lingered months too long till we arrived and his wife offered a couple hits and a bong. Our food stamps donor friends there grooved a bodhisattva from the dance countdown to ecstasy, while time lolled indifferently. As we returned north on I-5, starlight poured from speeding cars, and Dave's tape deck played Spiders from Mars. Was it a party or substance abuse?
So did you ask yourself that question quite often after going to a party?
Yeah. Okay, this one is about the post-impressionist painter Paul Cézanne. Cézanne refused. Year after year, his entries turned down by the salon, he yearned for Provence. While strolling under the chimney smoke and sallow sunlight of Paris, he pictured to himself the violet-gray clouds wreathing Mount St. Victory and the red roof spilling to the Mediterranean. For days, he labored in his atelier on a single still life, the green of pears cooling his fierce mind, the scarlet apples igniting his heart. He said, art should tell us what the eye thinks. In his final years, after an auction of his work in Auch, copies of the local newspaper's critical review were left at his doorstep by some of the town's middle class. Attached to them were messages asking him to leave the village he was dishonoring with the lurid colors and slanting angles of his canvases. So he tramped north over the bleached out meadows of the valley, the bourgeois house still blackening his thoughts, to his cabin on the side of the limestone mountain. Withdrawn in the swarthy shadows of the studio there, he continued the raw new tilt of his subjects, his gaze and brush siring the visions of Matisse and Picasso.
Too early, with too many provocative shapes and colors, right? It's such a sad story of artistic struggling. And you've got a lot of poems that show that struggle. The ones of Van Gogh, for example.
Oh, yeah. He had a terrible time.
Full of sorrow.
As far as this Cézanne goes, I read one of the articles, or I saw mention of articles they called his. Someone reviewed his paintings, and he just used a phrase the reviewer did, love of the ugly, you know, and that was really pretty cruel. So,
yeah,
and that got attached to him, and then he probably wasn't really famous till after he was dead, you know, and people realized how ahead of his time he was. You know, he was a precursor of Cubism, really, like I say, sired the visions of Picasso and Matisse. La Vie en Rouge after Van Gogh. The peasant women still harvest red grapes into twilight by the copper-stained Rhone, flowing with shards of cathedral glass. In the foreground, the painter watches and notes their labor upon his canvas beneath the blazing white syntime sinking in the west. He hears them gossip as they work in their heavy and aquamarine clothes amid the vineyards, filling with crimson yet to seep from his severed ear. They ignore him now. To them, he is Le Fou Rouge, trailed by giggling children as he makes his way through Arles streets to the fields under the fiery stare of the noon high sun. Later, he would go back to the yellow house and the crooked walls of his bedroom where portraits looked down on him with pitying eyes. He would lie down and listen to solitary footsteps in the night darkening with whispers as he contemplated the coming winter and the arrival of Gauguin.
Would you like to read follow-up of the Van Gogh one with the reference in it?
One with Van Gogh references and also a lot of the scenes from Ballard and Missouri as well. Van Gogh interlude, on a trolley bus leaving Ballard, wires conduct electricity, of the Arles sun thick with blackbirds, crying out an insanity. I hear an old blonde Ostrogoth woman with a raw cigarette cough, which spurs a deep self-recrimination that's impossible to turn off. Now I listen to many decades of repartee whirling in my mind, like monotonous heavens arrayed with glittering stars to strike me blind. It is a long way from small town Missouri, where I entered noisily in a ward watched by doctors who worked methodically. When did I realize that my fate was in a far-flung gray city, adrift and partially insensate to my loud anonymity? Now I need the clouds that shaded all theirs, from the strange intensity of the smoldering orb I've chased into another century. I need a respite in the slate blue calm of summer sky's long gaze and the dark eyes of women to make the bed of my numbered days.
Very much of Van Gogh's imagery and the beginning here, perhaps, of your inclusion of blackbirds, whether they're crows, ravens, jackdaws, right, yeah, and such. You have a fascination with them, as many poets do,
right,
and for good reasons too. You've been listening to Sound Poetry. I've been your host, David Gilmore, with Seattle poet John Gorski. Thank you.
Thank you, David.